Hi, I'm Leon Gorin, president of PEO Leadership, a peer-to-peer leadership advisory firm. We're an amazing community of CEOs, presidents, and senior executives. Ask yourself, are you learning as fast as the world is changing? It's time for Ontario business leaders to band together for counsel and support. It's time for you to tap into the business wisdom of our peer groups and unlock new ways to grow. I want you to come out of this COVID crisis a better leader and your organization ready for what's next. Take the first step at peo-leadership.com.
Welcome to our special PO Leadership Live webcast with Hunter Milburn, President and CEO of the Milburn Group. For those of you joining us for the first time, it's great to have you with us. You're among an incredible group of Canadian leaders who are here today in the room. These leaders are participants in advisory boards that are both focused on helping each other to succeed, both personally and professionally. And in normal times, participation in our community is of immense value in helping you sort of leverage the wisdom experience of not only your peers, but the advisors and chairs that sort of walk along with you in your journey, keeping you focused on what you identified as your goals and objectives. In a crisis like COVID-19, the value actually becomes tenfold, because where else can you turn where you have a group of leaders where you can be open, vulnerable, and be able to talk and ask them for counsel, clarity, and perhaps even some courage during these times? Over the last several weeks and during the crisis, I can tell you these boards and our leadership have been focused on items like cash flow in the early days, employees. Many of you have gone through a bunch of the furloughs and some of the challenges and the subsidies and the grants from the government programs, stakeholders, communication. We talked about mental well-being in isolation, managing your family, and of course, wealth preservation. In terms of why are we working and hopefully building our wealth and during this crisis, being able to maintain it. As we move forward sort of from crisis mode to transition and also, you know, at the end of the day, I believe a reset, our focus and conversations are going to move towards re-engaging the workforce, changing business landscapes, and of course, setting a new agile strategy, which I like to call sort of pivoting today to ensure we're prepared for this new world. So I'm not here to preach about the organization, but I will say if you don't have an advisory board at this time, please feel free to lean in to us reach out to us, and I'd be happy to see if we can help in any way. Now, before I introduce our speaker, a few logistics and how the webcast will unfold. Hunter is going to probably speak for about 15 or 20 minutes and give us a bit of an overview on the real estate market. And what I'd like everyone to do, we'll have everyone on mute, is to, as you're thinking of questions, please post them in the group chat to everyone. So we'll be watching the group chat, and as the questions arise, when Hunter's complete the actual formal part of the presentation, we'll go to Q&A. And in those questions, if your name is there, what I will do is, or Kelly will help me with, is we will unmute you so you can ask the question. If your name's not there, then I may just ask a question on your behalf. It's better if you guys ask the questions if I can get to you. So on that note, let me introduce Hunter. Hunter Milburn is a nationally recognized as the Dean of Condos by Canadian Business Magazine. Through his firm, Milburn Real Estate, Mr. Milburn has been personally responsible for the marketing and sales of over $25 billion in properties, having sold over 100,000 units. He has over 38 years of experience. Hunter, I'm not aging you here, by the way. Okay. I just 38 years of experience. He's well known for his entrepreneurial style, creative problem solving, and innovative market penetration strategies. Milburn Real Estate has served hundreds of clients on a range of projects, from vacation homes to high density multi-use developments and locations around the world, selling more than 700 developments since its inception. Milburn Real Estate continues to hold a 12% market share in Toronto, in an industry with over 1,000 competing companies. The high measure of his success is evident. So on that note, Hunter, it's a pleasure to have you with us today, and I will hand you over the virtual microphone.
Thanks very much, Leon, and welcome everyone, and thanks for taking the time to listen to our thoughts and insights and opinions. You know, it's dangerous to make predictions, but I think you can definitely have opinions, you know. In my career, I focused mainly on Toronto and mainly on pre-construction residential. So that's our primary area of expertise. But over the years, we did a lot of work for companies like IntraWest, where we marketed ski and golf product throughout North America, different ski resorts and golf courses. So a lot of that experience was international. And we do have some interests. We used to own the rights to Canada for Sotheby's Realty, as many of you know, and we sold that a few years ago. And we purchased the rights to Sotheby's in the Middle East. So we own the rights for Sotheby's for Dubai and the Saudi, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, and also for Montenegro and Serbia. So we have a little bit of an insight into Europe and the Middle East and what's happening there. I have a lot of partnerships with mainland Chinese people, so we have a little bit of insight there. And you know, I'm going to touch on what's happening in those other jurisdictions, which may shed some light on what might happen here next. So basically, I want to... And again, most of my experience has been on pre-construction, but it definitely also relates to the general resale market too. And you know, over the years, we've been requested by the OMB or different arbitrations to give an expert opinion. So I guess that's you know, makes our opinion maybe a little bit more credible than an ordinary opinion. But nevertheless, whenever you're dealing with crystal ball kind of things, it's more difficult, but the past and present we can certainly deal with. So one of the first things I wanted to mention was just really basic supply and demand economics of Toronto, because many of you may have an idea that there's a little bit more demand than supply, but when you start to quantify those numbers and really see the extent of it, you know, that's the reason why, regardless of business cycles or regardless of downturns, if you really understand those fundamentals, I think it's evident that prices will go up and will continue to go up, notwithstanding that they won't necessarily go up in a straight line. A few years ago, CMHC, which is our federal housing agency with no axe to grind or no bias, like many of us have, being human nature. So CMHC came out with a study that said, based on the historical and present and future population growth of Toronto, that the city needs 50 to 55,000 new homes per year delivered to keep a balanced market of supply and demand. So what's been happening over the last 10 or 15 years is that the city has been receiving around 30 to 35,000 new homes per year. You know, that 35,000 top number was, let's say, 2017, which was a record year of volume. And then in 2018, it was down to 22,000. So those are sales. Those aren't deliveries. But then they translate into deliveries 3 to 4 years later. So one of the things that happened that, you know, is something that's on everybody's radar to a certain degree, but even the impact of it at the time that it happened and later on was not really significance of it wasn't felt by me. But in 2005, when the province decided that, you know, you can't keep having this sprawl and continuing to eat up the province's farmland with subdivisions, so they created the Greenbelt. So they basically one day froze about 800,000 acres of potential development land in the Golden Horseshoe in a big U-shape all around Toronto. So the effect of that was, because you have Lake to the south and now you have to the north, east, and west a Greenbelt, you had the effect of making Toronto an island. And we often use these analogies in our presentations in terms of the long-run effects of supply and demand and what that's going to happen. In fact, CIBC came out with a study in 2012 after the effects of that Greenbelt had been in effect for seven, eight years. And basically said that the most expensive real estate in the world were the islands, Singapore, Hong Kong, Manhattan, because you had this very limited supply and very strong demand. And their opinion was that basically the Greenbelt had the effect of creating Toronto as an island, because there was basically a very severe and restricted 905 development. So you were either in 416 or 705, if you can make the area code analogy. So pre-2005, if the total annual supply of new homes was around 30,000, 35,000, About two-thirds to 75% of those homes were low-rise, single-family, townhouses, basically ground-oriented. Within 10 years, 2005 to 2015, that total supply number had not changed, but with the Greenbelt and with a comprehensive intensification policy with the province, they said, look, we have to have supplies. If we can't have it in single family, we have to have it in multifamily. So here's the transit, here's the Metrolink's forecast, here's the transit stops, here's the GO train station. So those areas have to intensify. So in 2005, out of that 30 to 35,000 new home delivery, two-thirds to 75% was low rise. By 2015, it was the other way around. So only 25% to a third was single family, and the rest was a multifamily. So for us, that was a great boon for our business because, you know, we had a lot more supply to sell and a lot more demand to take it up. So now if you start to compound that with the fundamentals and the premises behind CMHC study, is basically the net in-migration to Toronto is estimated to be around 125,000 to 140,000 people per year. So 350 people every day move to Toronto. Maybe not every day, but that's what it averages out to. What happened in the last 3 years with federal immigration, in 2018, we had 300,000. In 2019, we had about 330,000. This year was projected to be 340,000. Approved federal immigration, and majority of those people coming to Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal. So obviously 2020 is going to be way off that target. But the 6.8 million people that today live in the GTA, within 20 years is predicted to be 10.5 million, and within 10 years is predicted to be 8.5 million. So there's a lot of people going to move to Toronto in the next 10 years. Some of that is from foreign immigration. Some of it is from domestic immigration. I mean, if you're 18 or 20 or 22 and you're living in Waterloo or Windsor or North Bay, Barrie, if you're in a lot of other medium, small and medium-sized cities and towns, you know, you really want to come to where the jobs are, to where the fun is, where the action is. So there, that immigration, that net immigration to Toronto is composed by natural increase, the domestic immigration, and the foreign immigration. And even if there's a big pause in that, which is what we're experiencing now, which may last 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, who knows, it doesn't really change those fundamentals of that supply and demand. So I remember we did an opening for a project a few months ago, and I was given this little script that was prepared by the sales manager, and I read this one sentence, and I said, did anybody do a fact check on this? Because it sounded to be astoundingly optimistic. And basically what it said was that Toronto created more tech jobs in the last 5 years than New York, Seattle, Washington, and Silicon Valley combined. And, you know, they did their fact check and it turned out to be true. But to me, you know, even being an industry expert or so-called, you know, something like that was really kind of an astounding thing. And, you know, the mega projects that you have coming downtown, we have Google, the new city that has hired us to help them with their plan. There's East Harbor, which was that old Lever Brothers factory down by the BMW dealership and Don Valley Parkway. That's 12 million square feet of commercial and retail, no residential, with about 70,000 jobs. The project that we were bringing out was a project in Regent Park. And one of the corollary statistics was that we would need 70 buildings this big to house all the workers that ultimately would be in that East Harbor community. So basically, the fundamentals of Toronto are excellent. You know, they're not going to go away. They're not going to change. You know, North America's fourth largest city, inching ahead of Chicago a few months ago, Toronto is also the fastest growing large city. The other thing that that happened was that there was a study done by a company called Ryder Levitt Bucknell, which was a cost consultant, much like a Finnegan Marshall or Altus Hellyer or Pelican Woodcliffe, but more international based. And they have a study, they do it twice a year, called the King of Cranes. And they've done it for 10 or 12 years. And what they do is they analyze how many cranes there are in the top 14 cities in North America. And, you know, where do they stand? Well, for the last 10 years, it's been a kind of a one-sided race. It's basically like the Olympic athletes running against the high school athletes. So in those 14 cities, there were 455 cranes. And in Toronto, this was for last year, there were 121, which was just under 30% of the 14 cities' cranes were in Toronto. If you added in 905 in the suburbs at the transport nodes, that number of cranes went up to 246. So just to give you an idea who were second, third, and fourth, I mean, Los Angeles was a distant second at 47. Calgary was third at 37, which is nice to have an American city in there. Seattle, 36, and San Francisco, 33, kind of rounded out the top five. And this has been the case for many, many years. So I think that whatever happens in the short term, medium term, long term, you can't get away from that disequilibrium of supply and demand in the city, and that really can't help but affect price. Plus the municipalities, I mean, they do their best at processing projects, but, you know, we have a small project that many of you who know me, we worked on for about 5 years. We just got it approved in November, and it's a 26-unit little high-end infill project in Rosedale. So it's in the official plan that this site would be a four-story apartment building. But notwithstanding that, with slow city processes and ratepayers and obstacles, it took 5 years to get that approved. And it's going to be launching soon. Because what we find in these times is that the very, very low end works and the very, very high end works, where the issue is really in the middle, which is obviously most of the volume. So, you know, what happened to our group and volume in the last few months, I think in the last few years is relevant, you know, because again, because we're dealing with primarily pre-construction, and because pre-construction is a pretty discretionary purchase, it's not like a resale where you've got existing real estate and it's driven by need. People need to move. They need something bigger. They need something smaller. You know, you don't have to buy a condominium today that you're going to get delivery in 4 years from now. You can wait. You know, in an average month, we would sell between 300 and 500 units on a pre-construction basis, depending on the month and different time of the years. In March of this year, we sold about 200. We had three or four projects that did well. We had sales offices that were closed for renovations that reopened. We did one launch that did probably about 50% of what we would have expected it to do under normal circumstances, because we had to switch right in the middle of the launch from a completely contact-based and event-based program to a digital and social distancing type of situation. So in April, I'm thinking that we're probably going to sell maybe 75 to 100 units. So it's probably down 75%, which I think in the resale market, volumes that I'm hearing are down about 25 or 30% because it's more need driven. As far as occupancies are going and construction, I mean, the projects that are almost finished, like we're occupying a few projects now. One is called The Brit, which was the old Sutton Place. One is 11 Wellesley, which is a 600-unit building at the southwest corner of Yonge and Wellesley. And we have a two-tower project called Sonic, Supersonic, at Don Mills Road in Eglinton. So all of those projects are in occupancy, and supply chains really aren't that affected. They're going to be a little bit delayed, primarily because, you know, the workforces are maybe at about 75% capacity because some people aren't coming to work. But the deliveries are probably going to be delayed, maybe a couple of weeks or a month, but the actual registrations and closings are probably going to be on schedule or relatively on schedule with minor delays. So I think, Leon, I think that was really the main points that I wanted to talk about. The only other thing to mention would be in the resale market, because if we look back to the last downturn of 2008, 2009, you know, we didn't really have a big subprime mortgage crisis because we didn't have a subprime mortgage market. You know, the difference between Canadian lenders who underwrite and loan their own money and want it back to the fee-based US lenders who basically, there was a group of people that basically would package a bunch of mortgages and then sell them. So the people who were underwriting and doing the loans weren't the ones who were motivated to see them get repaid. They were motivated to get more packages sold so they could generate more fees. And I think that was the difference between Canada and the US. But in both of those years, the GTA was pretty much on target for its total volume, but the volume was squeezed into the first three quarters of 08 and the last three quarters of 09. And what happened was that in the new sale world, you know, the margins, I think there's a bit of an illusion out there with people that the developers are making these huge margins. But if you think of a project, let's say it's a $200 million sellout, if on sales, on revenue, it might make 10 or 12 or 15% on a good day. On costs, it might make 15 or 20%. You know, obviously with leverage, it's going to be very attractive. But, you know, it's not the kind of thing that a developer can all of a sudden one day say, well, I'm going to take 10% off the price and sell my project now, because the chances are a Canadian bank's going to look at it and say, well, you know, your margin is too thin, notwithstanding your sponsorship, and we're not going to give you a construction loan to build that project. So rather than prices moving on the pre-construction side, usually it's just a pause. With respect to the resale market, I think there, because it's need-based, your volumes are going to drop. I mean, a lot of the CIBC and World Bank studies said that the market might drop 20% in volume. I think that might be light. It might be conservative. It might drop a lot more, just because I think people are apprehensive. You've got job losses. You've got losses in equity markets, which are going to take a lot of people out of the market. And, you know, again, that's kind of crystal balling a little bit. But I think that's really my message so far. And so maybe we can open up to questions, Leon.
Before we head into the Q&A portion of this webcast, first, a brief note about PEO leadership from one of our members.
At PEO Leadership, I'm surrounded by other business leaders who challenge me to become better.
Les Mandelbaum, founder and CEO of Umbra.
Leaders really need to step outside their world and get new perspectives.
PEO Leadership is more than peer-to-peer advisory. It's a community of top executives with global experience.
Our retail landscape is rapidly changing. PEO Leadership has been vital in helping us navigate through this.
The time to step up and lead is now. Go to peo-leadership.com.
Thank you, Hunter. That's great. Maybe I'm going to spearhead the first question. With closings that are coming up right now on those new builds, so basically getting ready for occupancy, and the Canadians, you know, the market talking about how highly leveraged all these Canadians are. We've had a drop in, you know, a lot of liquidity challenges for some of the Canadians losing jobs. Do you think some of these closings will be affected? And would that actually impact the market prices on that resale?
You know, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because the projects that I mentioned that went, let's say 11 Wellesley, 600 units, Brit, 700 units, Sonic at Don Mills Road and everything, Eglinton, 650 units, the market value for, let's use Sonic as an example, today is about 900. If that project was to launch today, it would be about $900 a square foot. Because we sold it 3-4 years ago, a lot of it was sold at $600 to $650 a square foot. So there's a big lift in the purchase price of those people and what they're closing at. You know, we also have a separate little company that's a sister company with some other partners called Harlow, which we created a few years ago, that is designed to, can we sell a building out at the beginning? That building has 10 units left for sale that we never sold, so it's not enough to really move the dial. But that sister company, Harlow, specializes in rentals and assignments. And, you know, we're doing rentals and assignments there. So in the last 3 or 4 months, now it's slowed down in the last week or two, we've probably done about 75 to 100 rentals and about 20 or 25 assignments. So people have actually been purchasing those units to move into from investors that bought 3 or 4 years ago. The investors have been making a nice profit. But those are the occupancy closings. So let's say that building is registered in the summer, and then the final closings happen a month later. You know, there may be some issues there with respect to mortgage approval. So is it realistic that a small percentage of those people who lost their job, keep in mind all the cash that they need is paid in the deposit. So really it's just the mortgage approval. So, you know, whenever we've experienced these downturns before, it hasn't really affected closings too much in the beginning. So I don't think that's going to be a big issue. Now, depending on how long this lasts, and even if we fast forward a year, there's still going to be a big spread between what people paid and what people will close at. If you fast forward maybe a year and a half to 2 years, you know, the projects that were sold a year and a half ago, you know, were higher prices. So that spread isn't as big. So there might be more of an issue with some of those. But I don't think there's, it's funny in the, you know, I have to update my bio there because it's more like 45 instead of 38. But in that 45 years that we've been busy doing this, you know, you always think, well, gee, you know, we're going to close this 2-tower, 1,000-unit project. You know, is this the time when all of a sudden the apartments aren't going to rent out, or the rents are going to drop because there's such a big supply in the market, or there's going to be a bunch of units that don't close? Like if you know, I did a little webinar yesterday with our stakeholders, our staff and other brokers, and I took everybody through a little brief history of time in economic history. And, you know, here's the April 74 spec tax, you know, here's the bubble of 89-90, you know, here was the dot-com crisis, 9/11, Great Recession, too. You know, in all of those instances, there were really very, very few new sales that upon delivery didn't close.
So that's great. Thank you, Hunter, for that. Fadi, I know you've got a question. Come to you. Fadi, do we have you?
Yeah, hi. There. I was asking, do you think there will be a hold or lockdown implemented on construction activities?
So the question was, do I think there'll be a lockdown on overall construction activities? I mean, so far the province has deemed residential real estate construction an essential service, and even the brokerage. So we're deemed an essential service, which I guess is comforting because we're in the company of the LCBO and the marijuana stores, you know. But I don't know that, you know, I think that there's right now, if a project is sold out and waiting to start construction, it can't start right now. It's not approved to start. But all of the ones that are under construction, the ones in their later stages, I don't think will be affected that much. The ones in the early stages might be affected and delayed just because of labor shortages or supply chain issues. So I think it depends on where that project is in the construction cycle. Listen, I guess nobody has that crystal ball. If things get worse, they could just say, okay, we're going to stop everything for a period of time. But, you know, hopefully they'll get this under control a little bit and things are going to get better. I know in reading all these bank reports, their underlying assumption was that we were going to have 12 weeks of severe restrictions. And then, you know, if we're 4, 5, 6 weeks in, you know, we're kind of, so what does that mean? Does that mean at the end of May or at the end of June, things are going to slowly open up a little bit? I know in Wuhan, which was where this virus started, they were on a lockdown for 76 days, which ended April 7th. So things have started to get back to normal there. We have partners in Shanghai that I keep in touch with every week. And in Shanghai, which is a pretty big city, I mean, the, you know, bars are open, restaurants are open, clubs are open, gyms are open. You know, they have social, there's measures in place. They have a severe controls at the airports on domestic and international flights, but it's getting back to normal. You know, if you look at a lot of European countries that have done worse than we have, you know, Spain or Italy, they've got a long way to go. I mean, I think that because we had this unprecedented event, you know, we had an unprecedented response, and I think appropriately from the federal and provincial and city governments, not only on an economic basis, but also on a policy basis. You know, in some more draconian societies, I talked to one of my partners in Dubai the other day, and he said that there's nobody on the streets. There's no cars and there's no people to speak of. I said, well, how do you go to the grocery store? And he said, well, in order to go to the grocery store, because it's basically a dictatorship. So you online make an application, say, this is the store I'm going to go to. This is who I'm going to go by myself. This is my license number. I'm going to leave at this time. I'm going to be there this long, and I'm going to be home by this time. So it's a pretty draconian set of rules there, but maybe that will mean that their whole situation gets better quicker. I'm not sure. But you know, no, this is a really an unprecedented situation. So everybody's kind of guessing. But I think with respect to the construction, I think that definitely the residential construction will continue, and you know, the effects will be much less on the projects that are more advanced.
Okay, thank you.
That's great. Hunter, as I'm waiting for some questions, you talk Toronto or GTA area. Do you have any concerns when you look outside of the Toronto areas, of the Montreal, the Vancouver's, any other cities that you would be concerned about?
Well, listen, I think if you look at the Alberta city, because oil price is, you know, I mean, oil prices are projected to average $30 for the last, you know, for the rest of this year. So that's not good news for the Alberta industry. It's not good news for the Canadian dollar. You know, maybe the silver lining on that is that because the Canadian dollar is 7 to 10% off its pace, I think yesterday was $1.41. You know, there may be more investments because the world pretty much functions in U.S. dollars. But I think that, you know, it's hard for me to comment on what's going to happen in those other cities. But you know, one of the messages that I said yesterday was that, you know, fiscal policy is federal. I mean, and same with monetary policy. So the U.S., and like it or not, Canada follows the Fed, right? So the Fed decides this is what we're going to do. Canada says, okay, me too. And for all of those other cities on the Crane study, everywhere else in North America except Toronto, I mean, we are so lucky, I think, to live in Toronto for many reasons, both economic and social. You know, it's the most tolerant city in the world, the most multinational, and the greatest restaurants, and, you know, it's just very tolerant. So that fiscal and monetary policy, when things like my forecast is that we're going to have an extended period of low interest rates, because this isn't going to get fixed overnight. It's going to be a very slow and U-shaped recovery generally for the economy. Like my personal belief is for our industry, which is pre-construction, it might be more like a V-shaped recovery because it stopped fast, but it may start fast because if interest rates are very low, you know, the brokers who sell in our industry need to make money. There's still lots of people who want to buy for a delivery 3 or 4 or 5 years down the road and experience that appreciation between when they buy and when they take delivery. So I don't know that I can comment too much on how it would affect the other cities, but I think in a negative way, but I think that what it'll do is that fiscal and monetary policy that's federal, when we are starting to come out of this, is really going to affect Toronto's economy and real estate market in a very positive way, because Toronto won't need the stimulus when it comes out, but it's going to get it whether it likes it or not because of the federal policies.
Thanks, Hunter. We got a question from Michelle, if we take her off mute. Not yet. Hold on. Try it now.
Okay. Hi, Hunter. I had two quick questions. One is, so you're not feeling that housing prices or condo prices in Toronto for the next year will take a dip? I know you said volume will be down, but I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are. And I know I'm asking you to crystal ball prices. And then the second question I have is about immigration. And given that we have a hard pause now, do you have a concern that this will linger and that those numbers that you're talking about, not maybe from outside Canada, not from inside Canada, but from outside Canada, will actually shift in that in a year time frame, maybe even longer, that we won't get the numbers coming in because of this virus?
Okay, well, this is an opinion, not a prediction, I guess. But my personal opinion is that I think, first of all, to answer the first question about prices, and will it come, I think, you know, we have to separate the market into two pieces. So let's say there's the pre-construction piece and the existing standing inventory resale piece. I think that, you know, one would have to be very naive to think that in a resale market, existing standing inventory condos and houses over the next 3 months to 12 months the prices aren't going to come down. As the volume comes down because of job losses and because of losses in equity markets, there's going to be a lot of buyers that are on the sidelines. So the need-based buyers that are buying existing inventory, I think that volume is going to drop, and I think those prices will drop. You know, whether they drop 5% or 15%, who knows? Also, it's going to be different neighborhoods, different, you know, it's different cities, it may drop significantly less in a place like Toronto than it would in Edmonton or Calgary. So I think that's my comment on that pricing. I think that, the second part of your question, so I want to make sure I get it.
Yeah, you had really good data on terms of immigration into Toronto.
Right.
And you're saying it was part of, you know, from across Canada, but just talking about the stuff from outside Canada, we've got a very hard stop on that now. No one's coming in, but the concern that this will linger like for a year or even more in terms of people just not coming to Canada, but not coming to Toronto.
Yeah, but that's a very good question. But if you think that, you know, the current population of GTA is about 6.8 million. So if immigration stopped, foreign immigration for the next 2 years, if it's 350,000 people a year that we're expecting, and, you know, 80 to 100,000 of those people are going to come to Toronto. So let's say there's 200,000 less people come to Toronto for 2 years, 100,000 a year. I think you're still going to get that domestic immigration. I don't really think that's going to move the dial too much in terms of lack of demand, because most of those people that come initially aren't buying right away anywhere. They're going into a rental for 3 or 4 years before they buy later. So my personal opinion is that I think that whether it's 6 months or 12 months or 24 months or 18 months, is that eventually that immigration is going to continue, and that, you know, the contacts and the people that I know in federal governments, you know, the federal governments aren't in the best shape either in terms of debt. And I think that you're going to see in the next, maybe not starting for another year, year and a half, I think you're going to see more immigration. I mean, the federal government talked about bringing that immigration up to 400,000 or 450,000. I think you might see more of an immigrant entrepreneur type program come back again and say, you know, bring a couple million dollars to the city or to the country, open up a business and let's check you out. And then you're going to become a citizen and get a passport. So I think I can see the renewal of some of those programs that we've had in the past. So I think that there's definitely going to be a pause. Nobody knows for how long. I don't think it'll move the dial that much in the overall market, but I think it'll come back stronger when it does come back.
Thank
you. Okay.
But that's my opinion, not necessarily a prediction, right?
Hunter, okay, so I'd like to go to Chris Lambeck. You've got a question.
Okay. Can you hear me? Hello.
Sorry, we can hear you, Chris. You're good.
All right. So my question was really how the consequences of the Airbnb inventory, both as it relates to the rental market, but also the valuations. So I saw a map somewhere online that showed all these Airbnb condominiums, or I guess locations, and there seemed to be a lot in the GTA.
So the question is
how that influenced that inventory of Airbnb, which is no longer as attractive of a revenue source for those folks, how that might influence both the rental market as well as the valuation of real estate properties.
Well, okay, that's a good question. There's two things there I think that would come to my mind. Number one is that there was a lot of criticism from politicians and people that, you know, if somebody was using what normally would be a residence, even if it's owned by an investor, it would be rented out to a long-term person. If they're using that for an Airbnb type unit, it takes away some of the rental stock. So that theory, in theory, would limit the supply of rentals if there's enough of them and force rents up. If it's now banned, or let's say not operating, there's a lot of small landlords who own one unit, two units, five units, that basically aren't going to have that income to pay mortgages. So, you know, it could affect them. But I think that there's two things. I mean, a lot of municipalities, we sold a building in October, November out in the West End on a street called Zora, 36 Zora, around Queensway and Islington, Queensway and Kipling. And we made it Airbnb eligible, because in your condominium documents, you can say that a building can be short-term or long-term rentals. What most condominiums say is that you have a minimum of 6 months or a minimum of a year lease. So the other thing is there's a self-policing issue happening with condo corporations now, that basically are banning, or effectively that it was happening a lot of towards the end of last year, where building people didn't, there was a lot of pushback from full-time residents where they didn't want people coming in and out like a hotel. So I think that effect could be there, and it would be, but I think that it's again, in the whole scheme of things, I don't know that the supply is enough to make it really that effective. I know one of the things that we're working on right now is in Niagara Falls. Like, Niagara Falls is really shut down. I mean, every hotel, I mean, just like everywhere else, but it's a bit eerie there, because normally when you go there, you've got, you know, it's 15 million visitors a year. So you've got 1.25 million, whatever, coming every month. And it's a little bit eerie. And we own some commercial properties there, some hotels. They're basically shut down. But we also own some development sites, and there's a GO train station in downtown Niagara Falls that right now there's one trip per day. But by the end of the year, Metrolinx has said, look, we're going to spend $4 million on the GO train station in Niagara Falls. And, you know, we're going to have 11 trips per day round trip. So we own two sites right across the street from that GO train station. And one of the plans that we have is to do a 20-story building, about 400 units. And really, whether we partner with Airbnb or basically just have them as a brand partner, is basically let it function, even though it's a residential building with residential cost structure. You know, we will make it like function like a hotel. And, you know, we're getting a lot of interest in that from different people who want to buy it, because, you know, when you do the math, if you rent a building like that for about 150 to 180 a year, you basically end up really making a great return, a lot more than you would make if you rented it out on a full-time basis. And in the downtown area, it's a little bit, you know, how do I say it? It's almost like Tijuana. You know, the downtown area of Niagara Falls is not like Clifton Hill. So it needs rejuvenation. So the city is really behind it. So something like there, where you're doing a whole lot of units in one place, might make a difference. But I think when you spread it over GTA, it's not going to be that significant.
Thank you.
Okay, I got another, I think, Airbnb. We got a lot of Airbnb questions here. Comment. This one asked for me to read it. It's from Rubik. It's from Elke. How do you see the risk of rental withdrawals when a landlord knows of the risk of not getting paid?
So, does that mean that fewer people would buy condominiums to rent? Because Yeah.
I think
I have a number of condominiums, let's say around 30 that I rent out. And so let's call it a middle-sized landlord. I don't own thousands of suites, but more than three or four. So I had two people that didn't pay their rent. They were self-employed. They lost a job. So we're working with them for March. Now, you know, as April, May, June go through, I mean, that number may increase, right? Again, it's. I don't know that there's a big market right now, even in a good time, where people purchase existing standing inventory condominiums and rent them out. I think most, there's obviously some, but there's no data on how many. Like, if there's, you know, there's 50,000 sales of homes and resales in Toronto every year. I mean, how many are bought by investors that rent it out, and how many are bought by users? But I know that in the pre-construction market, a good percentage of those, because if you're buying today for delivery 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, you know, our statistics will show that it's around, if it's a downtown project or a 416 project as opposed to a 905, the further out you get, the more users there are, and, you know, the further downtown you get. But let's say in a prime downtown location, it might be 50 to 60% investors. So when it comes time for delivery, some of those investors may resell, but most of them are going to rent. But that's 4 years from now. So I think one of the things that's safe to say is that by then, hopefully things will be back to normal. Otherwise, we'll have a lot more issues to deal with. I don't think there's a lot of people buying existing condos to rent them out. So if all of a sudden people say, well, I'm not going to buy a condo for an investment and close in 90 days because it's bad, I don't know that that takes a lot of buyers out of the market. I think that enough buyers are taken out of the market just simply because of job losses and equity market declines that, you know, someone can borrow on their house, they can borrow on their stock market portfolio. If everything's normal, there's a wealth effect. They're not afraid to move. I think a lot of people are taking a wait and see attitude in terms of just being on the sidelines to say, you know, whether it's because of inability or just prudence, right?
Right. Thanks, Hunter. We've got a question from Payman. If you'd like to, I could read your question, but Payman, if you want to come off mute, please do.
Hi, Hunter. My question is in regards to real estate agents and brokerages. Obviously, they've been highly impacted by COVID, like many of us. What do you think they should do to come out stronger on the other side? And if you were still a real estate brokerages, what kind of changes would you be implementing for your business? Just for clarity, I own a software company servicing real estate agents and brokerages. That's why I'm asking this question.
Okay. Well, we did, like I said, we did a little webinar yesterday, which was really our staff and a lot of the selling brokers, because most of the sales we make, probably 90% of the sales we make, we're the listing broker and there's a selling broker. So one of the things we discussed was, you know, the silver, you know, when things change, it forces you to do new things. You know, it's interesting, like I mentioned when I was just chatting with Leon and a few groups when we were getting on the call is, you know, I do a lot of speaking. I speak to 50 people, 20 people, 100 people. I did a big thing on March 4th for 1,000 people. And I typically don't get nervous because I'm talking about something I like and I know what I'm talking about, presumably, whether it's right or wrong, who knows. But the thing is, preparing for this last couple of little webinars and actually delivering them, I was a little bit nervous, which may sound very counterintuitive because it's much, you'd think, well, gee, how can that be logical? Because, you know, to get up in front of a group of people, they say, you know, people fear death, taxes, and public speaking. So, but I think it's just being out of your comfort zone. So I think one of the things that we're focusing on now is technology. So with a lot of our sales office is closed. So a customer can't come to the sales office. The selling broker can't come to the sales office. The selling broker can't really meet with the purchaser, and the selling broker can't really meet to get information with our salespeople. So everything's being done by phone and by video and digitally. So what we've done is we're attempting right now, and we're doing it, we're reacting because we didn't prepare for this because we didn't know, but you know, we're doing a lot of video presentations so that you can basically go through that sales office, if there is one, and get a presentation that you would normally get. You know, here's the building, here's the location, here's the sponsorship, here's the developer, here's the apartments, here's the amenities, here's the deposit structure, the different things. And you know, with DocuSign and with technology, I mean, we did a launch on a project called Notting Hill, which is at Kipling and Roy York area on Eglinton. So it's at a transit stop. And it literally launched, I think our kind of lockdown happened around March 12th, 13th, 14th. So we launched this one March the 10th. So it was really very, when things were semi-normal when it launched, but within a week, things became not normal. But because we were already into it, we said, okay, fine, let's just keep going and see what happens. And I would say it probably took us two or three times as long, and we got about half the result that we would have normally got. But when you think about that in today's world, it's still pretty remarkable because instead of selling 200 suites in 2 weeks, you know, we probably sold 100 in 6 weeks, which isn't bad. So I think that, you know, I'd be interested to learn more about how do we improve our digital and video and virtual abilities in a world like today, because I think that's what's going to happen, whether it's in a pre-construction situation, you know, even with appraisals. You know, we had a gentleman on our call yesterday who was talking about mortgage financings and approvals and closings and what was happening. And even, you know, people don't want an appraiser to come to their home right now to do an appraisal. The appraiser doesn't really want to go. So they're doing a virtual tour and, you know, getting everything done, but it's maybe a little bit more cumbersome.
Mm-hmm. Fabulous. Thank you, Hunter.
I have a question from GBK. GBK, you can come off mute or...
That's me. It's Greg King, Leon.
Oh, hey, Greg. You were looking for clarity around something.
Hunter, you mentioned back close to the beginning about the ratios of, low rise and multi-unit buildings being, it used to be about 3/4, and now it's 2/3 to 3/4 multi-residential, I think it was that you said. I was just seeking some clarity on sort of, do you have the breakdown now between like single family detached homes and then kind of low rise townhouses condos and the new builds? I'm curious as to what's actually.
Yeah. Like if we took, let's say 2017 as an example, in 2017, it was a record year. There were about 36,000 new sales. And of those 36,000, 29,000 were condominiums. So they were, you know, a mid-rise or a high-rise multifamily, call it 30, 40 units plus. So of the 7,000 that were ground-oriented, probably about 80% of those were single-family homes, and 20% of those were more like street townhouses. And then if you fast-forward to 2018, where it was lower, it was about 22,000. Last year, the sales volume was about 27,000. But it's pretty much that same ratio. It's about 75, and it's increasing now. It's about 75 to 80% residential condo multifamily versus 20% that's low rise. The numbers I quoted were what happened in the years around 2003, 4, 5, just before the green belt, where it was about 2/3 to 75% low rise and balance high rise to 2015, 16. So after 10 years of experience that green belt, the total market share flipped from the majority being low rise to the majority being high rise.
Right. And then in terms of single family dwellings, that's what percent? Would that be like 5% of the total or something like that?
Well, I think let's say if we take 2017, for example, keep in mind this is all new sales, right?
Brand new
construction. So if it was 36,000 in 2017 and 7,000 were low-rise homes and 80% of that was single, so about 5,500 would have been single family.
Okay.
And the balance, another 1,500 would have been townhouses.
So not a lot of low-rise townhouses are being built in Toronto these days.
Sorry?
Not a lot of low-rise townhouses being built.
No, I mean, the townhouse projects that we have, we have two for Mattamy and Downsview, and one is 40 units of stacks and the other's 42 units of street towns. We have that project I mentioned, Sonic. We have 22 street towns. You know, we have 15 coming out around Main and Danforth. We sold 32 a few years ago at Bloor and Dundas. I mean, typically they're smaller and they're fewer and farther between. You know, if you get to Markham, now you're going to have, you know, a project, maybe it's 100 townhouses or 150. But it's just that most of the land is zoned and expensive enough that the townhouse, it's difficult for them to work and they need a higher density.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, we have another question. Joanna, would you like to ask your question?
Yes, hi. So I have a question for anybody out there who has bought themselves a new build but are currently residing in an existing home. And so my question is, do you see the resale real estate market in mid to late 2021, especially for those people like myself who are in a position where they will be closing on their new build at that time and they'll be forced to sell their existing home or maybe keep it as a rental. Where do you see things going in 2021?
Okay, well, that's again, a prediction with a crystal ball. So, you know, I can give an opinion, but it's difficult to give it a prediction. I mean, my sense would be by the end of next year, things will be pretty much back to normal. So I think that, you know, if you purchased that unit a couple of years ago and you're going to get delivery of it in 2021, you might count on, depending on what stage, if it's half built, it might be 3 months to 6 months late. I mean, a lot of these things are late even at the best of times. So, you know, that's part of the challenge, is kind of just, if you are moving out of one place and into another, is just coordinating that move, so that it matches. But I think that, you know, and again, listen, it depends on the effect of the virus and how quickly, if there's a vaccine, it's kind of over. If there's just controls, then you could have a second wave. I mean, it's hard to say, but I think that, you know, we've got, you know, 7-8 months before the end of this year and another 12 months before the end of next year. So a year and a half, let's say. And I would suspect and hope that things are back to normal by then. But so I think you'll be fine, but I'm not sure, you know.
Great. Thank you.
That's great. Thanks, Hunter. We had one last question. I think Fadi, you can close it out with this last question. It's a bit of a crystal ball one, it looks like, too.
Yeah, that's more like a crystal ball, of course. Yeah, but I mean, an expert opinion would definitely help. Single homes, again, the same thing, but not coordinating any move or anything. Just what is the status going to be in 2021, given some people might want to be downsizing. Internal immigration might be slowing down because of not many offers and maybe not as many moves. It will always be there. So price-wise, is that still also going to be affected down?
Well, I think it depends on the time frame. I mean, I think that, you know, if buyers are on the sidelines, whether it's because of job losses or losses in the equity markets and the absence of a wealth effect, or just staying on the sidelines. I mean, if there's an absence of buyers, that's going to slow down volumes, which really in effect will have a meaningful effect on prices. So, you know, it depends on when somebody wants to sell and do they really have to sell. You know, I had a unit that I don't have to sell, but it's something I bought a few years ago. It has a very small mortgage on it and it has a big equity in it. So I thought, well, I'm going to put it up for sale. And it's a nice downtown building. It's a small one bedroom, but you know, in a normal world, that would have sold for about $650,000, maybe around $1,300 a square foot. So I'm going to put it up maybe at closer to 600, maybe 610 or 620, and it's rented. So if it sells, it sells, and if it doesn't, it doesn't. So it's not something that needs to happen. But if I was in a different situation, if I've only got one rental unit, and it's the tenant's not paying the rent and I have to sell it, then, you know, I have to basically, it's like a reverse auction. I have to put it on the market and basically wait for bids. And if there's fewer bids or no bids, then, you know, I have to make a decision as to what to do. So I wish I could give you a little more definitive opinion even.
Thank
but
you anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's better. Thank you.
Hunter, I just want to thank you very much for joining us today. Just, you know, I've known Hunter now for a few years, for those still in the room here, and I always think about anything I'd ever want to buy in real estate in the GTA, I'd want to phone Hunter first, because the guy knows almost every square inch of this marketplace and what could be happening across the street from the building that you would be thinking about buying today. So, Hunter, you're a wealth of knowledge, and really, really thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, I enjoyed it. I wasn't as nervous as I was with a lot of these other ones, you know, because I'm getting into a comfort zone now. But it's strange that it's really a lesson in human nature that you know, if you're used to one thing and now you're forced to do something different, it's not always easy, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks, Leon.
You're welcome. So, wishing everybody well, and if you're with us on Monday, I know we got Rosabeth Cantor joining us, who is a well-recognized Harvard professor, who recently released a book called Outside of the Building. So not outside of the box, but outside of the building, which I think actually is pretty critical now. As leaders, you need to really start thinking about, even with all the unknowns, how are we going to be pivoting our businesses into the future? Because there will be a time when we come out of this. So hopefully you're able to join us. Thank you again for joining our live webcast here at PO Leadership. Have a great day.